This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Everybody wants things to be simple, and we want to change nothing about our lifestyles. You know, just replace one thing with another. Plug in an electric vehicle for an internal combustion engine and change nothing about our lifestyles. You know, nothing about driving less, you know, nothing about consuming less.
Carbon offsets are often touted as a solution to humanity's bad habit of emitting an awful lot of CO2. But how many of us actually know what things like carbon offsets and carbon dioxide removal are all about? This week on Sea Change Radio, we revisit our 2023 discussion with David Ho, a professor in the Oceanography Department at the University of Hawaii and a co-founder of the nonprofit Seaworthy. We discuss his piece in the science journal Nature, explaining the shortcomings of carbon offsets, learn more about the mission of Seaworthy, and take a look at how some corporations greenwash the admirable goal of producing net zero goods. Then we hear an excerpt of a conversation we had earlier this year with Andrew Kaminsky, a journalist for Triple Pundit, as we look at the environmental impacts of extracting various minerals and discuss how mining companies are changing the way they operate. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by David Ho. David is a professor at the University of Hawaii in its Oceanography Department, and he's also a co-founder and the director of science at the nonprofit Seaworthy. David, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So first, why don't you tell us briefly what Seaworthy's mission is all about?
Yeah, so we're a nonprofit research organization that's focused on building free open source tools for verifying ocean-based carbon dioxide removal.
And give us an example of some of these tools in action.
Well, so they're mostly going to be modeling tools because it's a hard problem to observe in the ocean. And we need observations to calibrate and evaluate and validate the models. But eventually, they will be numerical models. So we're just building fit-for-purpose models that will allow people to make sure that they are taking up atmospheric CO2 in the amount that they claim they are, and to make sure that there aren't adverse side effects.
Yes, trying to verify the effects that some of these carbon dioxide removal tools or programs have seems to be a challenge. Why don't we create a little glossary for listeners before we dive into some of the details of what carbon dioxide removal is all about? Why don't you first kind of define CDR and then maybe also explain net zero and direct air capture?
Okay, so carbon dioxide removal just means that we use some sort of method to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and store it permanently, or at least for a long term, in some reservoir, either geologically or in the ocean or in products. And direct air capture, DAC, is one method that people have proposed. And it's sort of a straightforward sounding thing. You have a machine that sucks the CO2 out of the atmosphere, and then you have all this CO2 that you have to do something with. And one of the most obvious things to do is to sequester it in a geologic reservoir somewhere, or make it into rocks. And net zero is just this concept that, you know, your removal equals your emissions. So it's not real zero because you're still emitting something, but you're taking it out of the atmosphere in the same proportion.
We've set up a scenario where global emissions are almost a balance sheet, and companies can make deposits and then make withdrawals, and we've kind of made it all very clean on paper, but obviously it doesn't really work like that. So I wanted to turn to your piece in Nature, recent piece entitled "Carbon Dioxide Removal is an Ineffective Time Machine." I thought it was a really good analogy for explaining some of the shortfalls of how we view carbon dioxide removal. Why don't you kind of summarize your thesis first, if you can?
Well, so in that piece, I use this time machine analogy to help people understand scales, because I think we as humans, even I, have a real issue. And I say I because, you know, I work with these numbers all the time, but it's hard for me to relate to the difference between 1,000, 1,000,000 and billion, right? And oftentimes we're talking about emitting CO2 in billions of tons. Like right now, we annually emit about 40 billion tons of CO2 every year. And then you have these sort of projects that are taking up thousands of tons of CO2. And that sounds impressive, or even some of them have a goal of removing 1,000,000 tons, which, you know, really sounds impressive. But what does it really mean? So humans experience time, all of us, and we can sort of tell the difference between seconds, hours, days, years, right? But those also differ by orders of magnitude. And so, you know, I thought that to put it in the context of time makes it more relatable. So right now, if you remove 4,000 tons of CO2 from the atmosphere every year, that's 3 seconds. That's going back in time by 3 seconds compared to current emissions. And so, you know, while 4,000 sounds really impressive, when you put it into that context, you know, it's not as impressive. So it helps us contextualize what these big numbers mean, but it also gives you a sense of the challenge that we face.
Yes, why don't I quote you from the piece where you explain this 40 billion tons of CO2. You say, in 2022, the world emitted 40.5 billion tons of CO2. At that rate, for every year of operation, at its full potential, each hub would take the atmosphere back in time by almost 13 minutes. But in the time it took to remove those 13 minutes of CO2, the world would have spewed another full year of CO2 into the atmosphere. So we're kind of chasing our tail there, is your point, right?
Yeah, so the main point in the piece is that as long as we're emitting so much CO2, it doesn't make any sense to deploy carbon dioxide removal or CDR because it's futile.
You mentioned direct air capture, but planting trees has generally been kind of the standard for carbon dioxide removal. Are there others that are being touted by the science community?
Well, I hesitate to say the science community because I think scientists research these things that lead to people proposing them as solutions, and some of the people proposing them aren't necessarily scientists. And so I would say maybe just groups that are pushing it. I wouldn't necessarily say the scientists are the ones that are pushing it. There are different techniques. I think the direct air capture has sort of captured everybody's imagination at this point. But in terms of the methods that have actually removed carbon right now, trees are certainly one of those. And then the other ones also have to do with biology. There's something called biochar, which has to do with turning carbon into a form that it won't go back into the atmosphere. And then there are proposals where you will burn biomass to create energy, but you capture the CO2 from it. So that's bioenergy with carbon capture and sequestration. And then there are a lot of nascent methods that haven't removed. Now, that should include direct air capture as well. that haven't actually removed any CO2 or very little, has removed very little CO2, and that has potential that then, you know, people are researching, you know, the efficacy. And when I say efficacy, that includes the efficiency, but also the side effects.
Save the world, save the world.
You've got to save the world,
save the world.
All the boys and girls
from around the world.
You've got to save the world,
save the
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Professor David Ho. He is a professor in the Oceanography Department at the University of Hawaii. So, David, looking at carbon dioxide removal through a lens like this time machine analogy that you set forth can sound kind of depressing in a lot of ways, saying, well, this is all useless because we need to decarbonize before we can even get there. But you end on a very hopeful message in the piece, which is that we really need to prepare for when carbon dioxide removal will be necessary. You're saying it's not really necessary now, but we need to have the technology in place for when we're ready to kind of flick the on switch. Is that a fair characterization of your piece? Am I summarizing this correctly?
Well, I do think that we can be hopeful because there are methods that can help us decarbonize pretty rapidly. You know, the technology exists, right? And we have a lot of the knowledge. We know what's causing a lot of the, you know, extreme weather events that we're experiencing. And we know the solutions. So what keeps these things from being deployed a lot of the times is either state capture by fossil fuel companies or some other political barrier. But the barrier right now isn't technological. And so I think that should give us hope because, you know, we understand what's going on. It's not this thing that we can't fix at the moment. Like curing cancer, right? Like we want to do this and we don't know how. And that's frustrating. But it's not the same with climate. And related to your question about CDR, I think we definitely need to research it and test it because there will come a point where our emissions are low enough, but they're not zero, right? And to get to zero emissions, like we were talking about earlier, or net zero, or even to go to negative, because we might overshoot a bit, we need to have CDR in place. Because there will be these residual things that are, you know, sort of hard to abate, like maybe some of the manufacturing that we do with steel and cement or with global shipping or aviation. You know, those things are more difficult than getting everybody to drive an electric car, for instance. You know, to give a really extreme example, you know, if our emissions were only 1 million tons of CO2 every year, and our, you know, CDR methods are capable of removing 1 million tons, then it's a time machine that takes you back a complete year, right? Which is sort of the baseline of what we want. Maybe we need to have 2 million tons of removal, so we go back 2 years in case we overshoot. So yeah, it's the balance between emissions and removal.
And when we look at net zero from a corporate standpoint, when companies set forth goals of carbon neutral products, where do they get tripped up or where can they start fudging the truth? I just read a piece that you had reposted from Inside Climate News about Apple and its Apple Watch being a carbon neutral product, which seemed to be playing fast and loose with the truth.
Yeah, so I think some of that just comes from accounting and not rigorous verification of whatever they're claiming, either the renewable energy or the carbon removal, right? And if they're using forestry offsets to claim, you know, net zero emissions, we know that forests are not durable. You know, we see with all these forest fires of, you know, some of these forests are actually have been used for carbon offsets. And it's easy for them to go up in flames, especially as the climate changes. So some of it comes from that. And I think just in general, claiming products, especially, you know, something that takes so much manufacturing, takes so much resources to make, for a company to claim that it's carbon neutral sort of glosses over the sort of issue that there's no world in which, you know, we will achieve our climate targets without some increase in efficiency or decrease in consumption. And everybody wants things to be simple, and we want to change nothing about our lifestyles, you know, just replace one thing with another. Plug in an electric vehicle for an internal combustion engine and change nothing about our lifestyles, you know, nothing about driving less, you know, nothing about consuming less, and for everything to be okay. And I think that's just not the case. It doesn't mean that we can't ever consume anything, but, you know, as long as we're doing that, we're still flying, you know, we're still buying new clothes, you know, every month, it's going to be really hard to solve the climate issues that we have.
He's a professor at the University of Hawaii in the Oceanography Department, David Ho. David, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Andrew Kaminsky. Andrew is a sustainability writer and a journalist. Andrew, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
You've been working on this series for Triple Pundit, which chronicles a lot of the impacts of mining and the innovations in the space. You're based in South America, which is where a lot of major mining operations are underway. Before we focus on individual projects, give us kind of some overarching themes that you've pulled away in your work for this Triple Pundit series on mining. Like, where are the trends going? Are mining companies adapting to the new realities and the new demands for their products?
Right. Yeah. Thanks, Alex. I'll preface everything that I say by starting out that I'm not an expert. However, I speak to a lot of experts about the innovations in mining, the issues in mining, whether that's with human rights or environmental. So yeah, as you mentioned, I started this like responsible mining series with Triple Pundit. The series, we call it Undermining Progress, Human Rights and the Low Carbon Transition. And the idea for it was really that to reach the clean energy goals that the world has, whether that's net zero or at least lowering emissions, it's going to require a transition away from fossil fuels and into clean energies. And these clean energies require a lot of different minerals, from lithium, as you mentioned, copper, manganese, zinc, nickel, critical minerals. The list goes on. However, retrieving those, extracting those from the earth is not so straightforward and not necessarily clean, kind of undermining the whole clean energy, the push for clean energy that we mentioned. And some of those issues go on human rights, that mining companies and then their security teams, mining companies will make deals with national governments or states and then disregard the local communities living near where those minerals are, because you don't find the minerals usually in the big cities. You know, when I'm in Argentina right now, there's no minerals or mining activities here in Buenos Aires. However, if you go to the northwest of the country, you'll find the lithium triangle, which, as they call it, it's shared between Argentina, Chile, and Bolivia. And that's where a lot of the mining happens. And there's a lot of indigenous communities out there who are the ones that are impacted. Now, when mining companies sign these agreements with national governments, they're like, right, we've invested X amount of money. These minerals are ours, and we're going to make sure that we get our money back and we get our money's worth for mining these. And it's the often indigenous communities with smaller communities, rural communities that get the short end of the stick. And of course, also environmental issues. You're blasting tons of rock. The tailings that you're using after mining the rock is processed. There's a lot of social and environmental issues. And we wanted to look at, for this series, some innovative solutions and basically responsible approaches to mining and how you could make this push for clean energy minerals less intrusive. That's essentially the idea. And yeah, I think some of the things that I found is that there are a lot of people working to make this, to improve the state of mining worldwide. And it's really, when you look at all the impacts that mining has, you might get a little bit depressed and say, well, this is a horrible situation. There's no right answer. Fossil fuels are bad. Mining is bad. But as you look into it, there are a lot of people, good people doing good work. And as I mentioned to you prior, like it's one of the challenges they face, though, is that mining companies are reluctant to make changes to their processes that they've been doing for decades. They get minerals out of the ground, they do it well, and they get them to market. And they're not so interested in quickly ripping out the carpet beneath them and inserting a whole new process to manage things more responsibly. Of course, they say they want to, and part of me believes that they want to, but it's not so easy to make that happen. So that's certainly one of the challenges that startup companies and even large mining companies are facing when trying to improve the state of mining around the world.
You mentioned how these mining companies are often slow to pivot to new innovative practices. Obviously, it's a very varied and large industry, and it's far from monolithic. But if we could continue down the generalization path, do you see much differentiation in terms of what minerals are being mined and the size of the mining companies? When you start covering a big mining company that's mining for, let's say, gold, do you expect different impacts than if it was a small company mining for copper or lithium? And as a subset of that, also the region and the fragility of the area that's being mined.
What I have found is that the smaller companies are generally the ones that are more open to more sustainable practices, to trying new things. And that is probably true across the board, not just for mining companies, but also for, you name whatever big brands you want to talk about, like Walmart or Unilever. They're probably less open to trying something new because there's a lot of different processes and checks that they got to go through and approvals. I don't know if the minerals matter that much. I mean, with lithium these days, it's got more of a, this is the clean energy mineral. So maybe companies are a bit more careful about what they're doing with their lithium. But to me, I haven't really noticed a trend across what the mineral is. But the location or the region does seem to matter. A lot of the human rights abuses and environmental neglect tends to happen in countries with weaker governance that have, you know, there's less eyes on them, let's say. So if you've heard about cobalt mining in the DRC, the Democratic Republic of the Congo in Central Africa, that might be the epicenter for human rights abuses in mining. And it's in a country that doesn't have strong governance and a lot of watchful eyes over it. So you have some African countries that struggle with mining companies. Central America as well, you see some issues, and in South America too. I mean, it really is across the board. Southeastern Asia, Southern Asia, I've seen a lot of issues, but this happens too in like, I'm from Canada. This happens in Canada. This happens in the United States. I don't know that any country or region is immune to any negative impacts of mining. It's one of the impacts of blasting millions and millions of tons of rock to extract roughly 1% of that rock. These are some of the impacts that people living in the region and the environment in those regions are going to face. And while governance plays an issue, I don't know that it protects anyone completely from the negative impacts of mining.
So, Andrew, how have you seen the mining industry embracing the clean energy transition, and how much of it is real and how much of it is greenwashing, in your opinion?
They're embracing it full on. It's sort of their windfall is clean energy transition. And how much of this is greenwashing? I don't know. They're not so open about the impacts that they have, the environmental impacts, the human rights impacts. And it's difficult, I'll say, through the course of this series, getting mining companies to speak to me has not been easy. There's been a handful of times where I've been able to speak with some, but that's often the case. These smaller mining companies, like I mentioned, Skeena Resources, for example, that had the co-ownership model with the indigenous community. Larger mining companies, even ones that I've wanted to highlight some of the good things they're doing, they still are not willing to speak. I had to go through to eventually get the industry to talk to me. There's the ICMM, it's called. It's a International Council on Mining and Metals, I believe. And that's sort of an industry organization. They represent mining companies. And so I've spoke with them for a couple of articles. And they represent and have as their members many of the large mining companies. And they've said, hey, I can put a message out to our members to see if anyone wants to chat. But none of the mining companies really seem that interested in speaking with me, I'm not trying to demonize them. What I'm really trying to do is find solutions to some of the problems that are very well documented and well known in mining. But yeah, I don't know that mining companies are very in the public eye, whereas fossil fuel companies, like you mentioned, Shell, any of the big Esso or Exxon, the big fossil fuel companies are kind of household names.
Andrew Kaminsky is a sustainability writer and journalist. His pieces on mining can be found at triplepundit.com. Andrew, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Ike Turner and Tenacious D. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.